1.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up next is Democracy Now! Views expressed in this syndicated program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of CFRC 101.9 FM, Radio Queen's University.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
This is Bourne's, and you're listening to CFRC.
CFRC 101.9 FM has opened applications for its 2024-2025 Musicians in Residence program. Young and emerging artists are encouraged to apply to use CFRC studio space as an incubator to create new music, perform it live on air with video simulcast, take part in industry-related workshops for bands who are just starting out, and get paid. Learn more and apply today at cfrc.ca.
Kick your shoes off at the door.
Are you worried about the climate emergency and looking to do something about it? Join the Kingston Climate Justice Coalition for a special town hall event on Saturday, September 28th. Space is limited. Follow at Climate Coalition CA on Instagram and Facebook to register and learn more.
This is Democracy Now!
My children and I were at home, working and relying on God for support when the Israeli enemy hit us. They are just children, but it seems as if Israel is saying it's too much for us to even have a home.
Israel continues its bombardment of Lebanon with airstrikes across the country. Nearly 600 people have been killed, including over 50 children. Tens of thousands of people have fled their homes. Meanwhile, Hezbollah launches dozens of rockets at Israel, including a long-range missile fired at Tel Aviv that was intercepted. We'll go to Beirut for the latest. Then here in the United States, Election Day is less than 6 weeks away. We'll be joined by Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein.
My name is Jill Stein. I am the Green Party presidential nominee. And I'm here to lift up the voice of the people who say no to this genocide, who say no to the Democratic Party, who say no to the Republican Party.
We'll also speak with Green Party vice presidential candidate Butch Ware and Fuerza Mexicana, the past, present, and power of Mexicans in Chicagoland. Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez on his new report. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Tens of thousands of people have fled southern Lebanon as Israel's military continues its intense artillery and missile attacks. Lebanon's health ministry reports the death toll has climbed to at least 599 people, including 50 children. Meanwhile, Hezbollah launched dozens of drones and rockets at Israel, including a long-range missile fired toward Tel Aviv that was intercepted by Israeli air defense systems. Israeli public media is reporting Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant is readying troops for a possible ground invasion of Lebanon. In Beirut, officials say they've secured shelters for 10,000 people displaced from southern Lebanon. Some of the evacuees were forced into the same shelters they fled to nearly two decades ago during Israel's July 2006 assault. This is Felia Messen, a 58-year-old man who narrowly survived, a 58-year-old who narrowly survived a strike that destroyed her family home.
The rocket landed in front of me. I was shocked. I couldn't hear or see after that. Dust was all over the place. So I drove off quickly and headed to the upper road and kept going. I lost my temper because of what happened. It took me 12 to 15 hours to reach Beirut from Aitut because of the traffic congestion.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees reports two United Nations staffers were among those killed by Israeli attacks on southern Lebanon. Ali Basma worked as a janitor at the UNHCR's Tyre office for 7 years before he was killed in an Israeli strike on Monday. And Dina Darwish, a UNHCR staffer featured in many of the agency's videos, was killed along with her youngest son in an Israeli strike that seriously injured her husband and her other child. A separate Israeli strike killed cameraman Kamel Kariki of Al-Manar TV. He's at least the fifth journalist killed by Israeli attacks on Lebanon since October 7th. Meanwhile, Israel's military has continued its attacks on the Gaza Strip, with at least 53 Palestinians killed over the last 24 hours. Among the dead are a mother killed along with her five children when Israel's military bombed their house north of Rafah. In occupied West Bank, four Palestinians were shot and wounded as Israeli soldiers raided the Fawar refugee camp south of Hebron. Elsewhere, a Palestinian doctor was hospitalized in serious condition after he was shot by Israeli forces during a raid near the city of Qalqilya. Here in New York, world leaders gathered for the United Nations General Assembly Tuesday, condemned Israel's assaults on Palestine and Lebanon. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan accused Israel of committing genocide in Gaza and said the failure of nations to stop the violence showed the United Nations system and Western values are dying. Chilean President Gabriel Boric also condemned Israel's actions.
Me niego a elegir entre el terrorismo de Hamas.
I refuse to choose between the Hamas's terrorism or the massacre and genocidal behavior of Netanyahu's Israel. We do not have to choose between barbarities. I choose humanity. We denounce the illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories and the de facto denial of the existence of an independent Palestinian state by the occupying country.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres accused Israel of violating the United Nations Charter and said too many governments are turning a blind eye to international human rights conventions and the decisions of international courts. Meanwhile, Joe Biden delivered his last speech to the United Nations as U.S. president, calling for a diplomatic solution to end Israel's war on Gaza, even as his administration continues to provide weapons and billions of dollars in aid to Israel's military.
Working to bring greater measure of peace and stability to the Middle East, the world must not flinch from the horrors of October 7th. Any country, would have the right and responsibility to ensure that such an attack can never happen again.
In Ukraine, at least three people were killed and nearly three dozen injured Tuesday as a Russian bomb tore through an apartment block in Kharkiv. Ukraine's military says it shot down scores of Iranian-made drones launched by Russia as part of a wave of attacks that coincided with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's visit to the United Nations General Assembly. This comes as the Biden administration says it's sending Ukraine another $375 million in military aid, including rockets, artillery, and medium-range cluster bombs. The Arizona Democratic Party says a campaign office for Vice President Kamala Harris in Tempe was damaged by gunfire overnight Tuesday. It's the second time bullet holes have appeared in the office's windows in recent weeks. Harris is planning to visit Arizona in the coming days, where she's reportedly planning to visit the U.S.-Mexico border. Meanwhile, in Ohio, a Haitian immigrant rights group has brought criminal charges against Donald Trump and J.D. Vance over their false claims that Haitian immigrants living in Springfield are stealing and eating dogs and cats. Ohio state law allows private citizens to file affidavits bringing criminal charges. The Haitian Bridge Alliance wants Trump and Vance prosecuted for disrupting public services, making false alarms, telecommunications harassment, and aggravated menacing. Last week, the group's executive director, Gerline Joseph, spoke with Democracy Now!
Those type of narratives, when they think they're only attacking one person, one community, it has ripple effects. The reality now in Springfield, the entire community's lives are at risk. And what we are saying is currently this has been a tactic that's being used fear, division, and this is a time for all people in cities like Springfield to come together and fight against those hateful speech that literally are creating those security issues in Springfield and also in other places across the United States.
To see the full interview with Gerline Joseph of Haitian Bridge Alliance, go to democracynow.org. West Virginia Independent Senator Joe Manchin says he will not endorse Kamala Harris for president after she reiterated her support for ending the Senate filibuster. She told Wisconsin Public Radio this week she would seek to lower the threshold to pass legislation from 60 senators to a simple majority of 51 in order to restore abortion rights lost when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. That prompted this response by Senator Manchin.
Shame on her. Shame on her. She knows that filibuster is the holy grail of democracy.
Senator Manchin previously joined Republicans to filibuster the Women's Health Protection Act, which would have codified abortion rights into federal law. The chancellor of New York City's public school system is stepping down amidst a growing federal bribery investigation. David Banks' announcement comes just weeks after FBI agents raided his home and seized his phone. He's at least the fourth top official to resign from Mayor Eric Adams' administration over a sprawling federal corruption probe, which, among other things, is looking into whether Adams' campaign received illegal donations from Turkey. Recently, Adams' lawyer abruptly resigned. The state of Missouri has executed Marcellus Williams, despite new evidence suggesting he was wrongfully convicted. Williams died by lethal injection Tuesday evening after the U.S. Supreme Court denied a stay. He was 55 years old, a devout Muslim, an imam for other incarcerated people, and a poet. Jurors, the prosecutor, and the murder victim's family all begged that he not be killed. To see our coverage of his case, visit democracynow.org. Meanwhile, Texas prison officials killed Travis James Mullis on Tuesday. He's the fourth person to face lethal injection in Texas so far this year and the 16th nationwide, part of five executions scheduled across the United States this week. This comes as Texas lawmakers are urging authorities to grant clemency to death row prisoner Robert Roberson, who was convicted in 2003 for the murder of his two-year-old daughter, but has always maintained his innocence. Roberson's conviction was solely based on forensic testimony that cited the shaken baby syndrome hypothesis, which was popularized in the early 2000s, but never scientifically validated. Roberson is scheduled to be put to death October 17th. This is Texas State Representative Joe Moody of El Paso.
You cannot execute someone in a situation where there may not have been a crime committed. And the evidence in Mr. Roberson's case is of such a degree and such a magnitude that we have to push pause on this case. There is no disagreement that the government taking the life of an innocent person is wrong. And until we have these answers, this case cannot move forward.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
At least 22 people have been killed in Lebanon today as the Israeli military continues its bombardment across Lebanon. Israel's expanding the zones of attack with strikes for the first time on the beach resort town of Jiya, just south of Beirut, and Ma'isra in the mountains in the north. The death toll over the past 3 days is nearly 600 killed, including over 50 children, 40 women, with more than 1,800 people wounded. Tens of thousands have fled southern Lebanon, many going to Beirut and the coastal city of Sidon, and are sleeping in schools and parks in their cars. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees reports two United Nations staffers were among those killed by Israeli attacks on southern Lebanon. Ali Basma worked as a janitor at the UNHCR's Tyre office for 7 years before he was killed in Israeli strike Monday. And Dina Darwish, Bush, a 12-year staff member of UNHCR's Baqa office, who was featured in UNHCR videos, was killed along with her son in an Israeli strike that seriously injured her husband and another of their children. Another Israeli strike killed cameraman Kamel Karaki of Amanar TV. Meanwhile, Hezbollah launched dozens of rockets at Israel, including a long-range missile fired toward Tel Aviv that was intercepted by Israeli air defense systems. The UN Security Council has scheduled an emergency meeting on Lebanon today at the request of France. For more, we go to Beirut, where we're joined by Aya Mesjoub. She's Amnesty International's Deputy Director for the Middle East and North Africa. Welcome to Democracy Now! Aya, since you're right there in Beirut, just describe the scene on the ground in the country.
I mean, the onslaught that started Monday was really unprecedented. We saw tens and tens and tens of thousands of families hastily pack up their bags, leave their homes without any idea where they're going to next. All across Beirut now, you see cars that are parked with displaced families that have nowhere to go. The strikes have been expanding. There's a lot of misinformation around. People are paranoid about another pager walkie-talkie attack. I mean, the situation is really devastating. And Amy, there's, you know, I really want to put the death count into perspective here. In a single day, on Monday, more than 500 people were killed. And that is a really astounding number. It is one of the highest daily death tolls in recent global wars. It is higher than most daily death tolls in Gaza in the past year. You know, in Gaza, despite the horrific Israeli onslaught, it took 18 days for the death count to reach 500. This happened in Lebanon in about 24 hours. In 2006, the 33-day war that lasted, that took place between Hezbollah and Israel, resulted in 1,100 deaths over 33 days. We've already achieved half of that in just 24 hours. So the numbers are really unprecedented, and you see major panic across the entire country. People don't know where is safe anymore. The Israelis have expanded the areas that they're targeting. They're not limited to some areas in South Lebanon along the border and in the Baqa. They've really expanded inwards into coastal cities, into mountains in the north. It really feels like nowhere is safe, and people are very much at a loss for what to do and where to go.
And Aya, what about these phone calls and text messages and also reports of dropping of leaflets on the population by the Israelis? How are people reacting to that? And what indication do they have of even where to go?
So on Monday, the information minister said that around 80,000 people received calls to evacuate. And we tried to look into some of those calls, and there didn't seem to be any pattern for who was receiving these calls. Some people in Beirut received them. Some people in the south received them. In the Baqa, it was really all across the country. So it seemed like a tactic that was more intended to cause fear rather than an actual evacuation. Some residents in South Lebanon did get more specific evacuation orders. But again, under international law, for evacuation orders to mean anything, they have to be effective, meaning that people must have the time to leave and they must have the means to do so. What we saw on Monday was anything but. I mean, you know, people, the instructions that people got were stay away from, you know, Hezbollah targets. Nobody knows. A civilian doesn't know where a Hezbollah target is. So people just fled with the clothes off their back. It took 14, 15 hours for some families to make it from South Lebanon to Beirut. And we were receiving reports that that there were some strikes on, near where civilians were gathered to evacuate in traffic jams. We're still looking into those. But if that, holds up, then that is also a serious violation.
And I wanted to ask you that Amnesty is calling for an international investigation into the deadly attacks using these exploding portable devices. Could you talk about what you're calling for and why? And why isn't this patently labeled as a terrorist attack?
So under international humanitarian law and human rights law, we don't use the term terrorist attacks. For us, attacks are either lawful or unlawful. Our qualification of the pager attacks is if, as is being reported and as U.S. officials and Lebanese officials have said, Israel was behind the attacks, then international humanitarian law applies because these attacks were part of an armed conflict. Under international humanitarian law, it is prohibited to use weapons indiscriminately, which we found that the pager attacks were. The people who detonated the pagers did not know who was given the pagers or the walkie-talkies, and they did not know who would be around the individuals carrying those pagers and walkie-talkies. Therefore, the attack was indiscriminate and therefore unlawful under international humanitarian law and should be investigated as a war crime. The reason that Amnesty has called for an international investigation on this particular attack is because of the risks of this kind of warfare. It transforms everyday objects like pagers and walkie-talkies into essentially booby traps. And there is an explicit prohibition under international humanitarian law on the use of such booby traps. But we felt that, you know, such an attack, although it didn't cause nearly the same number of casualties as Monday's onslaught, did instill some fear and panic into the Lebanese society and is a really dangerous method of warfare to be using more to be using. It was unprecedented, and the involvement goes far beyond just, you know, the Israeli military. There are allegations around various shell companies. So we're trying to look into all of the multifaceted aspects of this attack, but we do feel that an international investigation in this case is warranted.
I want to ask you, Aya Mejdzoub, if you consider this a war on Hezbollah or Israel's war on Lebanon?
I mean, in terms of the impact on civilians, it is undeniable that Lebanese civilians are paying the price. You know, a lot of the media coverage of Monday's attacks was Israel strikes Hezbollah targets. However, you know, we've looked at entire neighborhoods that have been flattened, residential towers that have been brought down, people's livelihoods, their shops, their homes, their cars, all in ruins. You mentioned the deaths of the two UNHCR staff members. The health minister also mentioned the deaths of four medics and paramedics. Ambulances are being hit, medical centers. And, you know, the wave of displacement from South Lebanon, the Bekaa, and other areas is now, I think, almost 500,000 people have had to leave their homes. Not all 500,000 people are Hezbollah. So the impact on Lebanese civilians has really been catastrophic.
And the response of the United States, President Biden just gave his last speech at the United Nations as U.S. president. The EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, has characterized this as almost a full-fledged war. President Biden said too many on each side of the Israeli-Lebanon border remain displaced. Full-scale war is not in anyone's interest, even though a situation has escalated, a diplomatic solution is not possible, is still possible, he said. Aya Mejdzoub, at the same time, the U.S. continuing to provide billions of dollars to the U.S. military, to the Israeli military.
Yeah, I mean, there's an obvious hypocrisy there. We've consistently, since October 7, have been calling for the suspension of weapons sales and shipments to Israel. We've continued to call for respect of IHL. We have, in at least one instance, documented a possible war crime that Israel committed in Lebanon using U.S. weapons. So if the U.S. really was serious about a de-escalation in the region, then they should start by stopping arms and weapons shipments to Israel, and by also supporting judicial criminal proceedings, including at the ICC.
Ayemesh Zoub, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Amnesty International's Deputy Director for Middle East and North Africa, speaking to us from Beirut, Lebanon. Next up, here in the U.S., Election Day is just six weeks away. We'll be joined by the Green Party presidential and vice presidential candidates, Jill Stein and Butch Ware. Stay with us. Finding Strength Through Change by Lee Dines and the Jazz Tellers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. With Election Day less than 6 weeks away, we're joined now by Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein and her running mate, Butch Ware, a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. On Friday, the Green Party suffered a setback when the U.S. Supreme Court declined a request to put Stein on the presidential ballot in Nevada. The Democratic Party had sued to keep Stein off the ballot for failing to submit the proper forms. This comes as support for Stein has been growing in some areas over Vice President Kamala Harris's refusal to call for an arms embargo on Israel. CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, last month published a survey that showed Stein is leading Harris among Muslim voters in three battleground states, Arizona, Michigan, and Wisconsin. MPAC, the Muslim Affairs Public Affairs Council, the Muslim American Public Affairs Council, also recently endorsed Stein. This is Dr. Stein's third run for the presidency. Many Democrats view her as a spoiler candidate, pointing to the 2016 election when Hillary Clinton narrowly lost to Donald Trump. In that election, Clinton lost to Trump in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin by fewer votes than Stein had received. In this campaign cycle, Democrats have fought to keep the Green Party off the ballot, while some supporters of Trump have helped Green Party with obtaining ballot access. Former Trump lawyer Jay Sekulow recently represented the Green Party in its efforts to be placed on the Nevada ballot at the U.S. Supreme Court. Stein, though, like Ralph Nader before her, has described her campaign as one taking on the two-party duopoly in the United States. Jill Stein joins us from Boston, and Butch Ware joins us from Santa Barbara, where he teaches at UC Santa Barbara about the history of Africa and Islam. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's start, Jill Stein, by you telling us why you're running for president. What is you see is most important right now?
Well, let's put it this way. The American people are in crisis in virtually every dimension of our lives, whether it's the healthcare crisis and not being able to afford your pharmaceuticals. Some 8 million Americans are not able to afford their medications. 18 million were driven into poverty by the cost of healthcare in the last year for which data was available. Half of all Americans are struggling to keep a roof over their heads, severely economically stressed, trying to just pay their rent. You know, and we are spending half of our congressional dollars on the endless war machine, of which the this genocidal war against Gaza is one example that the American people vehemently object to. The American people are calling for other options. You know, who is anyone to say they should be denied, and that the two zombie political parties that have so poorly served the American public are the only options? You know, democracy is about competition. The American people are begging for other options. They are entitled to know who those options are. It speaks volumes that the Democrats are pulling out all the stops, including fraudulent impersonations of the Green Party, hiring infiltrators and spies, which they have publicly advertised for, and hiring an army of lawyers, in their own words, to basically throw their competitors off the ballot, quite simply because they are terrified of actually meeting us in the court of public opinion and having a real debate about the crises that the American people face and the real solutions that we alone are putting on the table, from Medicare for all to free public higher education to rent control across the country to 15 million units of so-called social housing, which would meet our housing needs, cutting the military budget, and above all, ending the genocidal war on Gaza right now, which the American people overwhelmingly support. A near supermajority actually supports a weapons embargo right now. And with Israel expanding this war not only into the West Bank, but also now into Lebanon, this is extremely, extraordinarily dangerous. And when we hear the Biden-Harris administration say that, oh, there's nothing they can do, their hands are tied, that's absolutely false. They can do like Ronald Reagan and simply make a phone call and instruct Israel that this genocidal assault is over.
Jill Stein, I wanted to ask you, immigration and border enforcement become a key issue in this election. There's a raging national debate on it. How do you and your proposals differ from those of Donald Trump or Harris?
Yes, and indeed, we've seen Harris and the Democratic Party continue to march to the right, basically adopting the policies of Donald Trump. We have a very different approach. In our view, the most important thing that we can do to fix the crisis of migration is to stop causing it in the first place through regime change operations, through economic neocolonialism and domination, through the climate crisis, and through the war on drugs. There are things that we can do actually right now that will decompress the pressures that are pushing people to seek refuge at our borders, and that includes on day one of our administration, we would legalize marijuana and undercut the power of the drug cartels to basically cause violence and wreak havoc on so many nations, particularly south of the border. We would not be overturning other democratically elected administrations, like, for example, the Aristide presidency of Haiti, which we overturned twice. And after doing that, the U.S. Under Hillary Clinton's Secretary of State administration, went in and reversed a minimum wage law that had raised the minimum wage from a pathetic 30 cents an hour merely to 60 cents an hour. And that was reversed by the power of the U.S. once we had overthrown the democratically elected government of Haiti. So, you know, it's no surprise with all the crises that the U.S. has been behind with our economic domination, our neocolonialism, our regime change operations, our war on drugs south of the border in particular, and also with our failure to actually take real concrete steps on the climate crisis, and that in turn is prompting so many millions of farmers to have to flee because they have no way of supporting themselves because of rampant drought and other climate instability. There is so much that we can do, not only to mitigate our own production of fossil fuels, which has skyrocketed actually under Democratic administrations far more than it has under the Republican administrations and which are not adequately addressed by the Inflation Reduction Act, which is more a fossil fuels first bill, if we have time to go into that. But we are not taking care of, you know, the many solutions we could provide right now, which would decompress the crisis at the border. And the last thing to say here is that instead of spending billions of dollars on a wall, which only kills people, kills wildlife, destroys ecosystems, instead, we can be investing those dollars into prompt screening, background checks, and to providing work papers for people promptly at the border. Because once migrants have crossed into this country and once they're papered and can work, they are an economic boon to any community and are worth trillions of dollars, actually, in economic development. Our communities would be competing for migrants rather than shutting them out if migrants were able to get to work. They not only, you know, pay their way, they actually contribute enormously to economic development and to the tax base of any community.
And Dr. Stein, I wanted to follow up. You were talking earlier about Gaza. This month, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, CAIR, published a poll that shows you are ahead of Kamala Harris among Muslim voters in key swing states like Michigan, Arizona, and Wisconsin. But yet the National Uncommitted Movement, which decided not to endorse any of the two major party candidates, also decided not to endorse any third party candidates. Wondering your response.
American and the Muslim American community is not simply uniform, but the CARE polls were quite comprehensive. So uncommitted is a smaller subset of that larger community. And it's very clear what the sentiment of the larger community is. They're absolutely up in arms because so many of their family members have been killed. You know, people who have lost tens or scores or even hundreds of family members. It would be a simple matter for the Democrats to recoup those votes if they wanted to. But it's more important to them to continue the genocide in Gaza than it is to win this election. And without the support of the Muslim vote, they will not win this election, and they cannot. So it's in their hands. They have the power to actually do what it would take to win back that very alienated and distraught vote, which is not coming to the Democrats as long as they continue to carry out this genocide. So it's on them. This is not something they can blame third parties on. They have lost that support. And the American people and the people of the world, you know, deserve an option which is actually consistent with the majority of American opinion, not just Muslim opinion, but the majority of American opinion and opinion around the world.
Before you selected Butch Weir as your running mate, several high-profile Palestinian and Arab rights activists said they were approached by your team, including Abed Ayoub, the director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and Palestinian-American lawyer and professor Noura Erekat. Professor Erekat tweeted, "I offered to join ticket if they would be willing to concede the election if Dems deliver on permanent ceasefire and arms embargo. The idea being use Stein's margin in three swing states to compel those concessions. If we truly believe the Dems would never concede, then there's nothing to lose. It also makes clear to those eager to throw Palestinians, Arab Americans, and American Muslims under the bus that if they lose to Trump, they are the source of their own loss. The Green Party rejected this, as they're accountable to their broader base and the health of their party. I understand that, but my priority in this moment is doing everything we can to end genocide by using all the leverage we have," Professor Noura Erekat said. Your response to that, Dr. Stein?
Yes. Let me say that ending the genocide in Gaza is not a quick fix. In the words of Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. The Green Party is here to continue to exert that pressure. Simply extracting a promise before an election is a very precarious thing to do. The Democrats might agree for a period of a week, and then they might find, oh, circumstances made us go back to continuing this war. So you really do not want to unilaterally disarm in this kind of situation. It would be extremely ineffective. More power to Nora Ericott for being the powerhouse voice that she is. Some of us have been, shall we say, in the political game for quite some time and have had time to observe how these various strategies do and don't work. And extracting a simple concession without, you know, without a permanent guarantee is a very risky proposition, especially because as an independent third party, the obstacles to gaining ballot status are so enormous that if you simply lay down your arms and you give up on the race, you lose your ballot status, and you lose it across the board in a way that you will not gain it back. By continuing to run for office, we maintain our ballot status, and we are able to continue to apply pressure against this very reckless and dangerous empire, which is a problem not only in Gaza, you know, but throughout the Middle East and around the world. We're currently engaged right now in two hot wars on the verge of going nuclear, and another third Cold War on the verge of becoming hot.
Let me ask you another question.
Does it make sense to surrender on it all?
I'm just hurrying because we don't have that much time. But New York Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was asked in a recent Instagram Live about voting for the Green ticket in November. This is what she said.
What I have a problem with is the fact that if you are running for president, you are the de facto leader of your party. And first of all, trust me on this. I run as a third party candidate in New York. I'm also run as a Working Families Party candidate in addition to running as a Democrat. Because trust me, I've been on record that about my criticisms of a two-party system. So this is not about that. But you are the leader of your party. And if you run for years and years and years and years and years in a row, and your party has not grown, and you don't add city council seats, and you don't add down ballot candidates, and you don't add state electeds, that's bad leadership. And that, to me, is what's upsetting. And all you do is show up once every 4 years to speak to people who are justifiably pissed off, but you're just showing up once every 4 years to do that? You're not serious. You're not to me, it does not read as authentic. It reads as predatory.
So that's New York Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Dr. Jill Stein, your response.
So, first of all, we don't go away between presidential elections. What goes away is the media coverage. And I'm sorry, you know, if you're only tuned into mainstream media and believe the propaganda that we go away. No, we're here. We are working. We are doing the work. We have elected, actually, some 1,500 local officials over the last two decades or so. We currently have 150 local electeds. We have to run at the national level. Unfortunately, because of the rules that Democrats and Republicans make, those rules require us, in order to maintain our ballot status and to run as Greens at lower levels, we actually have to run in many states at the presidential level. So this isn't a choice that we have. Furthermore, you can't compare Greens, which are a people-powered party under attack, above all by the Democrats, to the Working Families Party, which is really not a third party. It is a second ballot line for Democrats, either for current Democrats or for independents on their way to becoming Democrats. As such, they are not under attack by the Democratic Party. And what destroys third parties, and by the way, the Greens are the giant among third parties. So compare us to all other people-powered third parties. We are the only ones that manage to fight again and, you know, live for another day to continue the fight. And when you're fighting on such a very steeply tilted playing field, it requires building quite a head of steam in order to build support. And over the three races that I have run, and AOC is wrong on that, I was not running every 4 years. I didn't run last time. But it's very important that the party keep up its momentum in order to now be recognized as the alternative to the parties of war in Wall Street. So it's not like we're standing still. We're actually under enormous pressure that has essentially killed all other small parties, whether you look at the Labor Party that was launched at around the same time that the Greens were, the Peace and Freedom Party, which only got as far as 14 ballot lines across the country. They've been beaten back to just two. The Socialist parties, which used to be on the ballot all over the country, they've been beaten back to just a city council here or there. They do not have national ballot status anywhere except for PSL, which Party of Socialism and Labor and Liberation, which has it only in California. So true third parties, which are people-powered, which do not take their marching orders from the war machine, from AIPAC, from Big Pharma, we play on a very different playing field that AOC is not familiar with. And I'll just, conclude my comments. The nickname that my running mate actually gave to AOC is AOC Pelosi. What exactly is she doing with the battles that she has won? That's why we're in this race, so that we can truly serve the, the critical and dire needs of the American people.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Professor Butch Ware to the conversation. Professor, can you tell us why you decided to join the Green Party and run as a vice presidential nominee?
Yeah, when tagged into the fight by my sister soldier, Dr. Jill Stein, it was an easy decision to make. I had conducted an Instagram Live with her on my social media platform. I asked Dr. Jill about reparations after having recently posted a video of Kamala Harris where she hemmed and hawed and shucked and jived for 2 full minutes and then said the exact words, "I will never do anything that only helps black people." So when I asked Dr. Jill Stein about the question of reparations, she said they behave as though it's incalculable, but it's been calculated many times. It's between $10 and $13 trillion U.S., and I am in favor of cash payments. When I asked Dr. Jill about her resistance to this genocide in Gaza, I said that all of my colleagues in the activist and academic communities that are Palestinian liberation, not just advocates, but people that live this, breathe this, have skin in the game and have suffered, they were all voting for Dr. Jill Stein. So I didn't actually ask Dr. Jill about her support for Palestine. I'd seen her arrested at a pro-Palestine, a Free Palestine rally. I asked her about her overall foreign policy. And when I asked her about her overall foreign policy, her response was to say the approach of the Green Party is to dismantle the American empire. And I said in that interview, as a lifelong committed student of and exponent of and teacher of the Black radical tradition, yeah, and you better hurry up and do it quick before somebody else does it for you, because those two processes look very different. Pulling back those 700 military bases out of the 800 that we have around the world that actually serve no purpose except to antagonize local populations, and then, you know, slowly withdrawing from those other non-strategic positions in ways that keep Americans safe, that allows you to reinvest the $1 trillion, or really $1.3 trillion if you take all the auxiliary costs that are now being spent on the endless war machine. And it allows you to reinvest those things in social housing, in healthcare, in fixing the roads, in doing all of the things that the American government could do for the American populace. So when I was pulled into, when I was invited into the struggle against imperialism, into the struggle against white supremacy, into the struggle against capitalist exploitation, in my time, after having spent a lifetime teaching about this tradition, writing about this tradition, engaging this tradition at an activist level and as a community organizer, it was an easy decision. And before I even go any further, I just have to observe a moment of silence for Imam Marcellus Khalifa Williams, who was put to death yesterday by this corrupt imperialist state. And we heard nothing from the black woman who seeks to lead this country into the next phase, right? We heard nothing from the Biden-Harris regime, people who could at least speak, even if there isn't an immediate federal mechanism for clemency. We have a massive void of moral leadership in this country. And the last thing that I'll say by way of introducing myself to the American people on this particular program is that every effort to protect Team Blue, to protect the Democrats from facing accountability for the evil that their own hands have wrought is equally evil. If you are trying to shield them from the electoral consequences of 200,000 plus deaths in Gaza, the electoral consequences of 11 months of genocide, of increasing police murders in every single year since they have been in power, in sending troops in riot gears in Democratic-controlled cities, Democratic-controlled states to crack kids' heads like they did at UCLA, like they sent troops in riot gear to my own campus at UCSB, then you are part of the problem. Wake up and unplug from the propaganda machine. Everyone is fear-mongering around Trump as though fascism is not already here. So I have entered this fight alongside a lifetime humanitarian, peace activist, ecological conservationist and moral leader Jill Stein, in order to shake America out of its stupor. You have more choices than just blue militarized fascism or red militarized fascism. You can actually vote your conscience, vote green. And the last thing that I'll say is that, as Dr. Jill alluded to, the Democrat Party has already lost the swing states of Michigan, Georgia, and Pennsylvania. Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, ISPU, has publicly available data that the Democrats certainly saw before I saw it, that indicates that in the swing states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia, that Joe Biden received 65% of the vote in 2020, and the Democrats are polling under 15% in those states now. They could not have won the election without those swing states, and they could not have won those swing states without Muslim voters. Those voters are gone. They are not coming back. Dead man walking. The Democrats cannot win. And Dr. Jill and our host, Amy, have already cited the CARE study, but Yakin Institute will release this week, and I've been privy to this because of my long-term connections inside the Muslim community as a black Muslim man myself, that over 53% of the Muslims that they surveyed nationwide are now supporting third-party candidates, with something like 80% of those going to the Green Party, that the support for the Democrats and the Muslim community is at 15%, and it's at 4% for Trump. So this effort to try to pin an inevitable defeat of the Democrats upon third-party candidates or upon Muslims is at best disingenuous, and for those that with a clear sense of moral integrity, it is obviously gaslighting.
A last question to Dr. Stein, and we just have 30 seconds. You grew up in a Zionist household. How do you respond to those who say that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism as a Jewish presidential candidate? Just 30 seconds.
Yeah, so in brief, when I hear people equating anti-genocide, the resistance to genocide, saying that that is anti-Semitism, in my view, that is the most anti-Semitic thing one could possibly say, to imply that it's anti-Jewish to oppose genocide. Zionism and Judaism are very different. Zionism has been controversial within Judaism for much of the lifetime of Zionism. Zionism is a political ideology. It is not Judaism. And Gaza is not a war between Jews and Muslims. It is a war by Zionists on Jews, Muslims, and Christians.
Jill Stein, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Green Party presidential candidate, and Butch Ware, Green Party vice presidential nominee, a professor at University of California, Santa Barbara. Next up, Juan Gonzalez on the past, present, and power of Mexicans in Chicagoland. Stay with us.
Mi patria quiero cantarle ahora, y voy a hacerlo con todo el corazón. Desde la Baja California hasta Sonora, también Chihuahua, Coahuila y Nuevo León. México.
high-neck Mexican nation by Sones de Mexico Ensemble in Chicago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with a major new report on Chicago, where one in five people identify as Mexican. But they've been largely overlooked from politics to pop culture to academia until now. Our own Juan Gonzalez co-wrote the report Fuerza Mexicana, the past, present, and power of Mexicans in Chicagoland. Juan, talk about the significance of this report. You've just come off of a week of presenting it from legislators throughout Illinois to all sorts of politicians and people on the ground in Chicago.
Yes, Amy. Well, as a part of the Great Cities Institute at the University of Illinois Chicago, we were asked by a group of Mexican leaders of nonprofit organizations in the city to try to put together data specifically on the Mexican community, not the general Latino community, because unfortunately, most of the data collected by government agencies and research studies are under the umbrella of Hispanics or Latinos, and those are people from more than 20 different countries in Latin America, and they generally don't zero in on the specific condition of each of these ethnic groups. And the reality is that the Mexican community in the United States represents about 60% of all Latinos, but in places like Chicago, it's up to 75% of all the Latinos in the Chicago area are of Mexican descent. Yet there's no data on what the condition of the Mexican community specifically is. So we tried to put together in this report the first attempt specifically to disaggregate data among Latino communities and focus on the Mexican community in particular. And we issued the report actually last week on the anniversary of Mexican independence, September 16th. But it also has another significance in Chicago specifically, because it was 70 years ago last week, on September 16th, 1954, that the federal government launched Operation Wetback in Chicago. It had been launched in the Southwest earlier, but on that day, the INS swept through the city of Chicago, grabbing up Mexicans wherever they could to initiate a mass deportation. And if it sounds familiar, it's because this has happened repeatedly throughout U.S. history, of mass deportations of Mexicans, beginning with the Hoover administration in the 1930s, the Eisenhower administration in 1954, then the Bush administration with their raids in the early 2000s, the Obama administration with their mass deportations. So this has been a regular feature of American history. So we issued it on that day specifically to say, look, all of these mass deportations have occurred, and yet the Mexican community in the United States has continued to grow and has become pivotal. So I think the key things that there's lots of data in the report for people who are into, the nerds that are into data. But I think the major issues that we try to present is, one, that the Mexican community of Chicagoland, which is more than 1.5 million people, is not a new community. It's actually been in existence for more than 100 years, especially in the city of Chicago, and that has been critical to the vibrancy of Chicago, especially in the post-industrial age, when the manufacturing declined. It was really the growth of the Mexican community that allowed Chicago to experience an enormous renaissance. And just to give an example of the level of involvement of the Mexican community in Chicago's renaissance, for example, today, 51% of all the construction laborers in Chicago are of Mexican origin. So all of those skyscrapers and condominiums that have been refurbished and rebuilt have been built on the backs of low-paid construction laborers of Mexican origin. 71% of the landscapers in the city are of Mexican origin. 49% of the carpenters, 44% of all the cooks in the hotel hotels and the restaurants. 56% of all the auto mechanics in Chicago are of Mexican origin, and 36% of the factory workers, that is, those who are still working in factories in Chicago, are of Mexican origin. So really, the character of the Chicago working class has dramatically changed and is heavily Mexican. And in fact, there's an entire brown belt within Chicago of a dozen neighborhoods on the southwest side that are over majority Mexican. So there's been, in effect, Mexican migration saved Chicago. And unlike cities like Detroit or Indianapolis or Cleveland that also experienced post-industrial decline but never welcomed in large numbers of Latinos, by Chicago welcoming in Latinos, specifically Mexicans, it has been able to revitalize itself. So I think that's one of the key things. The other thing that's important to understand is the dispersion of the Mexican population. Two-thirds of all of the Mexicans, of those 1.5 million Mexicans, are not in the city of Chicago. They're in the suburbs and in the collar counties of Chicago. And there are now more than a dozen suburban towns around Chicago that have more than 50% Latino population, yet they have no Latino elected officials at the mayoralty levels or proportionally in the city councils. So the future of political representation and power of the Mexican and Latino community is really in the suburbs of Chicago. And that's true in cities across the country. It is in the suburbs that are the growth areas. The other important thing is that because the community is so young, the college-age population has dramatically changed. 32% of all the college and graduate professional school students in Chicago are Latino, 32,000 of them, including 20,000 Mexicans, which means that's the future of higher education for not only Chicago, but for many cities across the country. So these are just